The Devils of Fuatino. Of his many schooners, ketches, and cutters that nosed about among the coral isles of the South Seas, David Grief loved most the Rattler, a yacht-like schooner of 90 tons, with so swift a pair of heels that she had made herself famous in the old days, opium smuggling from San Diego to Puget Sound, raiding the seal rookeries of the Bering Sea, and running arms in the Far East. A stench and an abomination to government officials, she had been the joy of all sailoring men and the pride of the shipwrights who built her. Even now, after 40 years of driving, she was still the same old Rattler, fore-reaching in the same marvellous manner that compelled sailors to see in order to believe, and that punctuated many an angry discussion with words and blows along the beaches of ports from Valparaiso to Manila Bay. On this night, close-hauled, her big mainsail preposterously flattened down, her luffs pulsing emptily on the lift of each smooth swell, she was sliding an easy 4 knots through the water on the veriest whisper of a breeze. For an hour, David Grief had been leaning on the rail of the lee fore rigging, gazing overside at the steady phosphorescence of her gate. The faint backdraft from the headsails fanned his cheek and chest with a wine of coolness, and he was in an ecstasy of appreciation of the schooner's qualities. "She's a beauty, Taute, a beauty," he said to the Kanaka lookout, at the same time stroking the teak of the rail with an affectionate hand.
"Aye, skipper,"
the Kanaka answered in the rich, big-chested tones of Polynesia.
30 years I know ships, but never like this. On Raiatea we call her Fanoao."
"The Dayborn," Grief translated the love phrase. "Who named her so?" About to answer, Taute peered ahead with sudden intensity. Grief joined him in the gaze.
"Land," said Taute. "Yes, Fuatino," Grief agreed, his eyes still fixed on the spot where the star-luminous horizon was gouged by a blot of blackness. "I'll tell the captain."
The Rattler slid along until the loom of the island could be seen as well as sensed, until the sleepy roar of breakers and the blatting of goats could be heard, until the wind off the land was flower-drenched with perfume.
"If it wasn't a crevice, she'd won't run the passage on a night like this,"
Captain Glass remarked regretfully as he watched the wheel lashed hard down by the steersman. The Rattler, run offshore a mile, had been hove to wait until daylight before she attempted the perilous entrance to Fuatino. It was a perfect tropic night, with no hint of rain or squall. Forward, wherever their tasks left them, the Raiatea sailors sank down to sleep on the deck. Aft, the captain and mate and Grief spread their beds with similar languid unconcern. They lay on their blankets, smoking and murmuring sleepy conjectures about Matara, the queen of Fuatino, and about the love affair between her daughter, Naumu, and Motuaro.
"They're certainly a romantic lot,"
Brown, the mate, said.
"As romantic as Pilsach," Grief laughed, "and that is going some.
How long ago was it, Captain, that he jumped you?"
11 years,
Captain Glass grunted resentfully.
"Tell me about it," Brown asked. "They say he's never left Fuatino since. Is that right?" "Right-o," the captain rumbled. "He's in love with his wife, the little lassie. Stole him from me, and he's as good a sailorman as the trade has ever seen. Even if he is a Dutchman."
German, Grief corrected.
"Yes, all the same," was the retort. "The sea was robbed of a good man the night he went ashore, and no tutu took one look at him. I reckon they looked good to each other. Before you could say boo, she put a wreath of some kind of white flowers on his head, and in 5 minutes they were off down the beach like a couple of kids holding hands and laughing. You only hope he's finally blasted that big coral patch out the channel. I always start a sheet or two of copper whopping past."
"Go on with the story," Brown urged.
"Oh, that's all. We were finished right there. We got married that night. Never came on board again. I looked him up next day. Found him in a straw house in the bush, bare-legged, all mixed up with flowers and things, and playing a guitar. Looked like a bloody fool. Told me to send his things ashore. I told him I'd see him damned first. And that's all. You'll see her tomorrow. They got 3 kids now. Wonderful little rascals. I've a phonograph down below for him and about 1 million records.
And then you made him a trader?
The mate inquired of Grief.
What else could I do? Grief answered. Fortino is a love island, and Pilsach is a lover. He knows natives, too. One of the best traders I've got or ever had. He's responsible. You'll see him tomorrow.
Look here, young man, Captain Glass rumbled threateningly at his mate. Are you romantic? Because if you are, on board you stay. Fortino's the Isle of Romantic Insanity. Everyone's in love with somebody. They live on love. It's in the milk of the coconuts or the air of the sea. The history of the island for the last 10,000 years is nothing but love affairs. I know. I've talked with the old men. And if I catch you starting down the beach and...
His sudden cessation caused both the other men to look at him. They followed his gaze, which passed across them to the main rigging, and saw what he saw. A brown hand and arm, muscular and wet, being joined from overside by a second brown hand and arm. A head followed, thatched with long elfin locks, and then a face with roguish black eyes lined with the marks of wildwood laughter.
My God! Brown breathed. It's a fawn! A sea fawn!
It's the goat man, said Glass.
It's Mariri, said Grief. He's my own blood brother by sacred plight of native custom. His name is mine, and mine is his.
Broad brown shoulders and a magnificent chest rose above the rail, and with what seemed effortless ease, the whole grand body followed over the rail and noiselessly trod the deck. Brown, who might have become other things than the mate of an island schooner, was enchanted. All that he had ever gleaned from books proclaimed indubitably the fawn-likeness of this visitant of the deep.
But a sad fawn,
was the young man's judgment, as the golden-brown woods god strode forward to where David Grief sat up with outstretched hand.
David, said David Grief.
Mariri, big brother, said Mariri.
In the custom of men who have pledged blood brotherhood, each called the other not by the other's name, but by his own. Also, they talked in the Polynesian tongue of Fuatino, and Brown could only sit and guess.
A long swim to say Talofa,
Grief said, as the other sat and streamed water on the deck.
Many days and nights have I watched for your coming, big brother,
Moriri replied.
I have sat on the big rock where the blasting dynamite is kept, of which I have been made keeper. I saw you come up to the entrance and run back into darkness. I knew you waited till morning, so I followed. Great trouble has come upon us. Matara has cried these many days for your coming. She is an old woman, and Motauri is dead, and she is sad.
Did she marry Namu?
Grief asked, after he had shaken his head and sighed according to custom.
Yes, in the end, they ran to live with the goats till Matara forgave, when they returned to live with her in the big house. But he is now dead, and Namu soon may die. Great is our trouble, big brother. Tori is dead, and Tatitori, and Petu, and Nari, and Pilsach, and others.
Pilsach, too, Grief exclaimed. Has there been a sickness?
There has been much killing. Listen, big brother. 3 weeks ago, a strange schooner came. From the big rock I saw her topsails above the sea. She towed in with her boats, but they did not warp by the big patch, and she pounded many times. She is now on the beach where they are strengthening the broken timbers. There are 8 white men on board. They have women from some island far to the east. The women talk a language in many ways like ours, only different. But we can understand. They say they were stolen by the men on this schooner. We do not know, but they sing and dance and are happy.
And the men? Grief interrupted.
They talk French, I know, for there was a mate on your schooner who talked French long ago. There are 2 chief men, and they do not look like the others. They have blue eyes like you, and they are devils. One is a bigger devil than the other. The other 6 are also devils. They do not pay us for our yams and taro and breadfruit. They take everything from us, and if we complain, they kill us. Thus was killed Tori and Tatitoria and Petu and others. We cannot fight, for we have no guns, only two or three old guns. They ill-treat our women. Thus was killed Motuaro, who made defense of Namu, whom they have now taken on board their schooner. It was because of this that Pilsach was killed. Him, the chief of the two chief men, the big devil, shot once in his whaleboat, and twice when he tried to crawl up the sand of the beach. Pilsach was a brave man, and Notutu now sits in the house and cries without end. Many of the people are afraid and have run to live with the goats, but there is not food for all in the high mountains, and the men will not go out and fish, and they work no more in the gardens because of the devils who take all they have, and we are ready to fight. Big brother, we need guns and much ammunition. I sent word before I swam out to you, and the men are waiting. The strange white men do not know you are come. Give me a boat and the guns, and I will go back before the sun. And when you come in tomorrow, we will be ready for the word from you to kill the strange white men. They must be killed. Big brother, you have ever been of the blood with us, and the men and women have prayed to many gods for your coming, and you are come.
I will go in the boat with you, Grief said.
No, big brother, was Moriri's reply. You must be with the schooner. The strange white men will fear the schooner, not us. We will have the guns, and they will not know. It is only when they see your schooner come that they will be alarmed. Send the young man there with the boat.
So it was that Brown, thrilling with all the romance and adventure he had read and guessed and never lived, took his place in the stern sheets of a whaleboat, loaded with rifles and cartridges, rowed by four Raiatea sailors, steered by a golden-brown sea-swimming fawn, and directed through the warm tropic darkness toward the half-mythical love island of Fuatino, which had been invaded by 20th-century pirates. If a line be drawn between Jaluit in the Marshall Group and Bougainville in the Solomons, and if this line be bisected 2 degrees south of the equator by a line drawn from Ukuor in the Carolines, the high island of Fuatino will be raised in that sun-washed stretch of lonely sea. Inhabited by a stock kindred to the Hawaiian, the Samoan, the Tahitian, and the Maori, Fuatino becomes the apex of the wedge driven by Polynesia far to the west between Melanesia and Micronesia. And it was Fuatino that David Grief raised again next morning, 2 miles to the east and in direct line with the rising sun. The same whisper of a breeze held, and the Rattler slid through the smooth sea at a rate that would have been eminently proper for an island schooner had the breeze been thrice as strong. Fuatino was nothing else than an ancient crater thrust upward from the sea bottom by some primordial cataclysm. The western portion, broken and crumbled to sea level, was the entrance to the crater itself, which constituted the harbour. Thus, Fuatino was like a rugged horseshoe, the heel pointing to the west, and into the opening at the heel the Rattler steered. Captain Glass, binoculars in hand, and peering at a homemade chart spread on top of the cabin, straightened up with an expression on his face that was half alarm, half resignation.
"It's coming," he said. "Fever. It wasn't due till tomorrow. Oh, it always hits me hard, Mr. Grief. In 5 minutes I'll be off my head. You'll have to calm the schooner in. Steward, get my bunk ready, and plenty of blankets, and fill that hot water bottle. Oh, it's so calm, Mr. Grief, I think you can pass the big patch without warping. Take the leading wind and shoot her. She's the only craft in the South Pacific that can do it, and I know you know the trick. You can scrape the big rock by just watching out for the main boom."
He talked rapidly, almost like a drunken man, as his reeling brain battled with the rising shock of the malarial stroke. When he stumbled towards the companionway, his face was purpling and mottling, as if attacked by some monstrous inflammation or decay. His eyes were setting in a glassy bulge, his hands shaking, and his teeth clicking in the spasms of chill.
2 hours to get the sweat,
he chattered with a ghastly grin.
"And a couple more and I'll be all right. I know the damn thing to the last minute it runs its course. You take the..."
His voice faded away in a weak stutter as he collapsed down into the cabin and his employer took charge. The Rattler was just entering the passage. The heels of the Horseshoe Island were two huge mountains of rock 1,000 feet high, each almost broken off from the mainland and connected to it by a low and narrow peninsula. Between the heels was a half-mile stretch, all but blocked by a reef of coral extending across from the south heel. The passage, which Captain Glass had called a crevice, twisted into this reef, curved directly to the north heel, and ran along the base of the perpendicular big rock. At this point, with the main boom almost grazing the rock on the port side, Greef, peering down on the starboard side, could see bottom less than 2 fathoms beneath, and shoaling steeply. With a whaleboat towing for steerage, and as a precaution against backdrafts from the cliff, and taking advantage of a fan of breeze, he shook the Rattler full into it and glided by the big coral patch without warping. As it was, he just scraped, but so softly as not to start the copper.
File 2.
The harbour of Fuatino opened before him. It was a circular sheet of water, 5 miles in diameter, rimmed with white coral beaches, from which the verdure-clad slopes rose swiftly to the frowning crater walls. The crests of the walls were saw-toothed volcanic peaks, capped and haloed with captive trade-wind clouds. Every nook and crevice of the disintegrating lava gave foothold to creeping, climbing vines and trees, a green foam of vegetation. Thin streams of water, mere films of mist, swayed and undulated downward in sheer descents of hundreds of feet. And to complete the magic of the place, the warm, moist air was heavy with the perfume of yellow-blossomed cassia. Fanning along against light, vagrant airs, the Rattler worked in. Calling the whaleboat on board, Greef searched out the shore with his binoculars. There was no life. In the hot blaze of tropic sun, the place slept. There was no sign of welcome. Up the beach on the north shore, where the fringe of coconut palms concealed the village, he could see the black bows of the canoes in the canoe houses. On the beach, on an even keel, rested the strange schooner. Nothing moved on board her or around her. Not until the beach lay 50 yards away did Greef let go the anchor in 40 fathoms. Out in the middle, long years before, he had sounded 300 fathoms without reaching bottom, which was to be expected of a healthy crater pit like Fuatino. As the chain roared and surged through the hawse hole, he noticed a number of native women in flowing ahus, flower-crowned, stream out onto the deck of the schooner on the beach. Also, and what they did not see, he saw from the galley the squat figure of a native steel forehead drop to the sand and dive into the green screen of bush. While the sails were furled and gasketed, awning stretched, and sheets and tackles coiled harbour fashion, David Greef paced the deck and looked vainly for a flutter of life elsewhere than on the strange schooner. Once, beyond any doubt, he heard the distant crack of a rifle in the direction of Big Rock. There were no further shots. At the end of another hour, Captain Glass, under a mountain of blankets, had ceased shivering and was in the inferno of a profound sweat.
"I'll be all right in half an hour," he said weakly.
"Very well," Greef answered. "The place is dead, and I'm going ashore to see Matara and find out the situation."
"It's a tough punch. Keep your eyes open," the captain warned him. "If you're not back in an hour, send word off."
Greef took the steering sweep, and 4 of his Raiatea men bent to the oars. As they landed on the beach, he looked curiously at the women under the schooner's awning. He waved his hand tentatively, and they, after giggling, waved back.
"Talofa!" he called.
They understood the greeting, but replied,
"Iorana!"
And he knew that they came from the society group.
"Wahene!"
One of his sailors unhesitatingly named their island. Grief asked them whence they came, and with giggles and laughter they replied, "Huahene."
"It looks like old Dupuis's schooner," Grief said, in Tahitian, speaking in a low voice.
"Don't look too hard, and what do you think, eh?
Is that the Valletta?"
As the men climbed out and lifted the whaleboat slightly up the beach, they stole careless glances at the vessel.
"It is the Valletta," Taute said. "She carried away her topmast 7 years ago. At Papeete they rigged a new one. It was 10 feet shorter. That is the one."
"Go over and talk with the women. You can almost see Huahene from Raiatea, and you'll be sure to know some of them. Find out all you can, and if any of the white men show up, don't start a row." An army of hermit crabs scuttled and rustled away before him as he advanced up the beach, but under the palms no pigs rooted and grunted. The coconuts lay where they had fallen, and at the copra sheds there were no signs of curing. Industry and tidiness had vanished. Grass house after grass house he found deserted. Once he came upon an old man, blind, toothless, prodigiously wrinkled, who sat in the shade and babbled with fear when he spoke to him. It was as if the place had been struck with a plague, was Grief's thought, as he finally approached the big house. All was desolation and disarray. There were no flower-crowned men and maidens, no babies rolling in the shade of the avocado trees. In the doorway, crouched and rocking back and forth, sat Matara, the old queen. She wept afresh at the sight of him, divided between the tale of her woe and regret that no follower was left to dispense him her hospitality.
"And so they have taken Namu," she finished. "Mota Auri is dead. My people have fled and are starving with the goats, and there is no one to open for you even a drinking coconut. Oh, brother, your white brothers be devils."
"They are no brothers of mine, Matara," Grief consoled. "They are robbers and pigs, and I shall clean the island of them." He broke off to whirl half round, his hand flashing to his waist and back again, the big colt levelled at the figure of a man, bent double, that rushed at him from out of the trees. He did not pull the trigger, nor did the man pause till he had flung himself headlong at Grief's feet and began to pour forth a stream of uncouth and awful noises. Grief recognized the creature as the one he had seen steal from the Valletta and dive into the bush, but not until he raised him up and watched the contortions of the hare-lipped mouth could he understand what he uttered.
"Save me, master, save me,"
the man yammered in English, though he was unmistakably a South Sea native.
"I know you, save me."
And he broke into a wild outpour of incoherence that did not cease until Grief seized him by the shoulders and shook him into silence.
"I know you," Grief said. "You were cook in the French hotel at Papeete 2 years ago. Everybody called you Hare-Lip."
The man nodded violently.
"I am now cook of the Valletta,"
he spat and spluttered, his mouth writhing in a fearful struggle with its defect.
"I know you. I saw you at the hotel. I saw you at Levina's. I saw you on the Kittiwake. I saw you at the Mariposa Wharf. You are Captain Grief, and you will save me. Those men are devils. They killed Captain Dupuis. Me, they made kill half the crew. Two they shot from the cross trees. The rest they shot in the water. I knew them all. They stole the girls from Huahene. They added to their strength with jail men from Noumea. They robbed the traders in the New Hebrides. They killed the trader in Vanikori and stole two women there.
But Grief no longer heard. Through the trees, from the direction of the harbour, came a rattle of rifles, and he started on the run for the beach. Pirates from Tahiti and convicts from New Caledonia, a pretty bunch of desperados that even now was attacking his schooner. Hare-Lip followed, still spluttering and spitting his tale of the white devil's doings. The rifle firing ceased as abruptly as it had begun, but Grief ran on, perplexed by ominous conjectures, until, at a turn of the path, he encountered Mariri running toward him from the bush.
"Big brother," the goat man panted, I was too late. They have taken your schooner. Come, for now they will seek for you.
He started back up the path, away from the beach. Where is Brown? Grief demanded.
On the big rock. I will tell you afterward. Come now.
My men in the whaleboat. Mauriri was in an agony of apprehension.
They are with the women on this strange schooner. They will not be killed. I tell you true. The devils want sailors. But you they will kill. Listen.
From the water, in a cracked tenor voice, came a French hunting song.
They are landing on the beach. They have taken your schooner. That I saw. Come!
Careless of his own life and skin, nevertheless David Grief was possessed of no false hardihood. He knew when to fight and when to run, and that this was the time for running he had no doubt. Up the path, past the old men sitting in the shade, past Mataara, crouched in the doorway of the big house, he followed at the heels of Mauriri. At his own heels, dog-like, plodded Hare-Lip. From behind came the cries of the hunters, but the pace Mauriri led them was heartbreaking. The broad path narrowed, swung to the right, and pitched upward. The last grass house was left behind, and through high thickets of cassia and swarms of great golden wasps, the way rose steeply until it became a mere goat track. Pointing upward to a bare shoulder of volcanic rock, Mauriri indicated the trail across its face.
"Past that we are safe, big brother," he said. "The white devils never dare it, for there are rocks we roll down on their heads, and there is no other path. Always do they stop here and shoot when we cross the rock. Come!"
A quarter of an hour later, they paused where the trail went naked on the face of the rock.
"Wait, and when you come, come quickly," Mauriri cautioned.
He sprang into the blaze of sunlight, and from below several rifles pumped rapidly. Bullets smacked about him, and puffs of stone dust flew out, but he got safely across. Grief followed. And so near did one bullet come, that the dust of its impact stung his cheek. Nor was Hare-Lip struck, though he essayed the passage more slowly. For the rest of the day, on the greater heights, they lay in a lava glen where terraced taro and papaya grew, and here Grief made his plans and learned about their dangerous situation.
"It was ill luck," Mauriri said. "Of all nights, last night was selected by the white devils to go fishing. It was dark as we came through the passage. They were in boats and canoes. Always do they have their rifles with them. One Raiatea man they shot. Brown was very brave. We tried to get by to the top of the bay, but they headed us off, and we were driven in between the big rock and the village. We saved the guns and all the ammunition, but they got the boat. Thus they learned of your coming. Brown is now on this side of the big rock with the guns and ammunition."
"But why didn't he go over the top of the big rock and give me warning as I came in from the sea?" Grief criticized.
"He knew not the way. Only the goats and I know the way. This I forgot as I crept through the bush to gain the water and swim to you. The devils were in the bush shooting at Brown and the Raiatea men, and me they hunted till daylight, and through the morning they hunted me there in the low-lying land. Then you came in your schooner, and they watched till you went ashore, and I got away through the bush. But you were already ashore."
"You fired that shot?"
"Yes, to warn you. But they were wise and would not shoot back. And it was my last cartridge."
"Now you, Hare-Lip," Grief said to the Valletta's cook. This tale was long and painfully detailed. For a year he had been sailing out of Tahiti through the Tuamotus on the Valletta. Old Dupuis was owner and captain. On his last cruise, he had shipped two strangers in Tahiti as mate and supercargo. Also, another stranger he carried to be his agent on Fanriki. Raoul van Asveld and Carl Lepsius were the names of the mate and supercargo.
"They are brothers, I know, for I have heard them talk in the dark on deck when they thought no one listened,"
Hare-Lip explained. The Valletta cruised through the Low Islands, picking up shell and pearls at Dupuis' stations. Franz Amundsen, The third stranger relieved Pierre Gollard at Fanriki. Pierre Gollard came on board to go back to Tahiti. The natives of Fanriki said he had a quart of pearls to turn over to Dupuis. The first night out from Fanriki, there was shooting in the cabin. Then the bodies of Dupuis and Pierre Gollard were thrown overboard. The Tahitian sailors fled to the forecastle. For 2 days, with nothing to eat, and the Valletta hove to, they remained below. Then Raoul van Asveld put poison in the meal he made Harelip cook and carry forward. Half the sailors died.
"He had a rifle pointed at me, master. What could I do?"
Harelip whimpered.
"Of the rest, two went up the rigging and were shot. Fanriki was 10 miles away. The others went overboard to swim. They were shot as they swam. I only lived, and the two devils. For me, they wanted to cook for them. That day with the breeze, they went back to Fanriki and took on Franz Amundsen, for he was one of them."
Then followed Harelip's nightmare experiences as the schooner wandered on the long reaches to the westward. He was the one living witness, and knew they would have killed him had he not been the cook. At Noumea, 5 convicts had joined them. Harelip was never permitted ashore at any of the islands, and Grief was the first outsider to whom he had spoken.
"And now they will kill me,"
Harelip spluttered,
"for they will know I have told you. Yet I am not all a coward, and I will stay with you, and die with you."
The goat man shook his head and stood up.
"Lie here and rest," he said to Grief. "It will be a long swim tonight. As for this cook man, I will take him now to the higher places where my brothers live with the goats." "It is well that you swim as a man should, big brother," Mariri whispered.
From the lava glen, they had descended to the head of the bay and taken to the water. They swam softly without splash, Mariri in the head. The black walls of the crater rose about them till it seemed they swam on the bottom of a great bowl. Above was the sky of faintly luminous stardust. Ahead, they could see the light which marked the Rattler, and from her deck, softened by distance, came a gospel hymn played on the phonograph once intended for Pilsach. The 2 swimmers bore to the left, away from the captured schooner. Laughter and song followed on board after the hymn, and the phonograph started again. Grief grinned to himself at the appropriateness of it, as "Lead Kindly Light" floated out over the dark water.
"We must take the passage and land on the big rock," Mariri whispered. "The devils are holding the lowland. Listen!"
6 rifle shots at irregular intervals attested that Brown still held the rock, and that the pirates had invested the narrow peninsula. At the end of another hour, they swam under the frowning loom of the big rock. Mariri, feeling his way, led the landing in a crevice, up which, for 100 feet, they climbed to a narrow ledge.
"Stay here," said Mariri. "I go to Brown. In the morning I shall return."
"I will go with you, brother," Grief said. Mariri laughed into the darkness.
"Even you, big brother, cannot do this thing. I am the goat man, and I only, of all Fuatino, can go over the big rock in the night. Furthermore, it will be the first time that even I have done it. Put out your hand. You feel it? That is where Pilsak's dynamite is kept. Lie close beside the wall, and you may sleep without falling. I go now."
And high above the sounding surf, on a narrow shelf beside a ton of dynamite for blasting underwater coral, David Grief planned his campaign, then rested his cheek on his arm and slept.
File 3.
In the morning, when Mariri led him over the summit of Big Rock, David Grief understood why he could not have done it in the night. Despite the accustomed nerve of a sailor for height and precarious clinging, he marveled that he was able to do it in the broad light of day. There were places, always under minute direction of Mariri, that he leaned forward, falling across 100-foot deep crevices until his outstretched hands struck a grip on the opposing wall and his legs could then be drawn across after. Once there was a 10-foot leap above 500 feet of yawning emptiness, and down a fathom's length to a meagre foothold. And he, despite his cool head, lost it another time on a shelf, a scant 12 inches wide, where all handholds seemed to fail him. And Mariri, seeing him sway, swung his own body far out and over the gulf and past him, at the same time striking him sharply on the back to brace his reeling brain. Then it was, and forever after, that he fully knew why Mariri had been named the Goat Man. The defense of the big rock had its good points and its defects. Impregnable to assault, 2 men could hold it against 10,000. Also, it guarded the passage to the open sea. The 2 schooners, Raoul van Asveld and his cutthroat following, were bottled up. Grief, with a ton of dynamite which he had removed higher up the rock, was master. This he demonstrated one morning, when the schooners finally attempted to put to sea. The Valletta led, the whaleboat towing her, manned by captured Fuatino men. Grief and the Goat Man peered straight down from a safe rock shelter 300 feet above. Their rifles were beside them. Also a glowing fire stick and a big bundle of dynamite sticks with fuses and detonators attached. As the whaleboat came beneath, Mariri shook his head.
"They are our brothers! We cannot shoot!"
Forward, on the Valletta, were several of Grief's own Raiatea sailors. Aft stood another at the wheel. The pirates were below, or on the other schooner, with the exception of one who stood, rifle in hand, amidships. For protection, he held Namu, the queen's daughter, close to him.
"That is the chief devil," Mariri whispered. "And his eyes are blue like yours. He is a terrible man. See, he holds Namu, that we may not shoot him."
A light air and a slight tide were making into the passage, and the schooner's progress was slow.
"Do you speak English?"
Grief, hidden, called down. The man started, half lifted his rifle to the perpendicular, and looked up. There was something quick and cat-like in his movements, and in his burned blonde face a fighting eagerness. It was the face of a killer.
"Yes," he answered. "What do you want?" "Turn back or I'll blow your schooner up," Grief warned.
He blew on the fire stick and whispered, "Tell Namu to break away from him and run aft." From the Rattler, close astern, rifles cracked and bullets spattered against the rock. Van Asveld laughed defiantly, and Mariri called down in the native tongue to the woman. When directly beneath, Grief, watching, saw her jerk away from the man. At that instant, Grief touched the fire stick to the match head in the split end of the short fuse, sprang into view on the face of the rock, and dropped the dynamite. Van Asveld had managed to catch the girl and was struggling with her. The Goat Man held a rifle on him and waited a chance. The dynamite struck the deck in a compact package, bounded, and rolled into the port scupper. Van Asveld saw it and hesitated. Then he and the girl ran aft for their lives. The Goat Man fired, but splintered the corner of the galley. The spattering of bullets from the Rattler increased, and the 2 on the rock crouched low for shelter and waited. Mariri tried to see what was happening below, but Grief held him back.
The fuse was too long," he said. "I'll know better next time."
It was half a minute before the explosion came. What happened afterward, for some little time, they could not tell, for the Rattler's marksmen had got the range and were maintaining a steady fire. Once, fanned by a couple of bullets, Grief risked a peep. The Valletta, her port deck and rail torn away, was listing and sinking as she drifted back into the harbour. Climbing on board the Rattler were the men and the Huahene women who had been hidden in the Valletta's cabin and who had swum for it under the protecting fire. The Fuatino men, who had been towing in the whaleboat, had cast off the line, dashed back through the passage, and were rowing wildly for the south shore. From the shore of the peninsula, the discharges of 4 rifles announced that Brown and his men had worked through the jungle to the beach and were taking a hand. Grief and Mariri joined in with their rifles. But they could do no damage, for the men of the Rattler were firing from the shelter of the deckhouse, while the wind and tide carried the schooner farther in. There was no sign of the Valletta, which had sunk in the deep water of the crater. 2 things Raoul van Asveld did that showed keenness and coolness. Under the Rattler's rifle fire, Raoul compelled the fleeing Fuatino men to come in and surrender. And at the same time, dispatching half his cutthroats in the Rattler's boat, he threw them ashore and across the peninsula, preventing Brown from getting away to the main part of the island. And for the rest of the morning, the intermittent shooting told Grief how Brown was being driven back in again to the other side of the big rock. The situation was unchanged, with the exception of the loss of the Valletta. The defects of the position on the big rock were vital. There was neither food nor water. For several nights, accompanied by one of the Raiatea men, Mauriri swam to the head of the bay for supplies. Then came the night when lights flared on the water and shots were fired. After that, the water side of the big rock was invested as well.
"Oh, it's a funny situation," Brown remarked, who was getting all the adventure he had been led to believe resided in the South Seas. "We've got hold and can't let go, and Raoul has hold and can't let go. He can't get away, and we're liable to starve to death holding him."
"If the rain came, the rock basins would fill," said Mariri.
It was their first 24 hours without water.
"Big brother, tonight you and I will get water. It is work for strong men."
That night, with coconut calabashes, each of quart capacity and tightly stoppered, he led Grief down to the water from the peninsula side of the big rock. They swam out not more than 100 feet. Beyond, they could hear the occasional click of an oar or the knock of a paddle against a canoe, and sometimes they saw the flare of matches as the men in the guarding boats lighted cigarettes or pipes.
"Wait here," whispered Mariri carefully, "and hold the calabashes."
Turning over, he swam down. Grief, face downward, watched his phosphorescent track glimmer and dim and vanish. A long minute afterward, Mariri broke surface noiselessly at Grief's side.
"Here, drink."
The calabash was full, and Grief drank sweet, fresh water, which had come up from the depths of salt.
"It flows out from the land," said Mariri.
"On the bottom?"
"No, the bottom is as far below as the mountains are above. 50 feet down it flows. Swim down until you feel its coolness."
Several times filling and emptying his lungs in diver fashion, Grief turned over and went down through the water. Salt it was to his lips, and warm to his flesh, but at last, deep down, it perceptibly chilled and tasted brackish. Then, suddenly, his body entered the cold subterranean stream. He removed the small stopper from the calabash, and as the sweet water gurgled into it, he saw the phosphorescent glimmer of a shark like a sea ghost drift sluggishly by. Thereafter, holding the growing weight of the calabashes, he remained on the surface, while Mariri took them down, one by one, and filled them.
"They're sharks,"
Grief said, as they swam back to shore.
"Pooh," was the answer. "They are fish sharks. We of Fuatino are brothers to the fish sharks."
"But the tiger sharks, I have seen them here."
"When they come, big brother, we will have no more water to drink, unless it rains."
A week later, Mariri and a Raiatea man swam back with empty calabashes. The tiger sharks had arrived in the harbor. The next day, they thirsted on Big Rock.
"We must take our chance," said Grief. "Tonight I shall go after water with Mau Tau. Tomorrow night, brother, you will go with Teha."
3 quarts only did Grief get, when the tiger sharks appeared and drove them in. There were 6 of them on the rock, and a pint a day, in the sweltering heat of the mid-tropics, is not sufficient moisture for a man's body. The next night, Mariri and Teha returned with no water. And the day following, Brown learned the full meaning of thirst, when the lips cracked bleeding, the mouth is coated with granular slime, and the swollen tongue finds the mouth too small for residence. Grief swam out in the darkness with Mau Tau. Turn by turn they went down through the salt to the cool, sweet stream, drinking their fill while the calabashes were filling. Mau Tau had descended with a last calabash, when Grief, peering down from the surface, saw the glimmer of sea ghosts and all the phosphorescent display of struggle. He swam back alone, but without relinquishing the precious burden of full calabashes. Of food, they had little. Nothing grew on the rock, and its sides, covered with shellfish at sea level where the surf thundered in, were too precipitous for access. Here and there, where crevices permitted, a few rank shellfish and sea urchins were gleaned. Sometimes frigate birds and other seabirds were snared. Once, with a piece of frigate bird, they succeeded in hooking a shark. After that, with jealously guarded shark meat for a bait, they managed on occasion to catch more sharks. But water remained their direst need. Mariri prayed to the goat god for rain. Taute prayed to the missionary god. And his two fellow islanders, backsliding, invoked the deities of their old heathen days. Grief grinned and considered. But Brown, wild-eyed with protruding blackened tongue, cursed. Especially he cursed the phonograph that in the cool twilights ground out gospel hymns from the deck of the Rattler. One hymn in particular, Beyond the Smiling and the Weeping, drove him to madness. It seemed a favourite on board the schooner, for it was played most of all. Brown, hungry and thirsty, half out of his head from weakness and suffering, could lie among the rocks with equanimity and listen to the tinkling of ukuleles and guitars, and the hulas and himines of the Huahene women. But when the choir voices floated over the water, he was beside himself. One evening, a cracked tenor took up the song with a machine.
Beyond the smiling and the weeping, I shall be soon. Beyond the waking and the sleeping, beyond the sowing and the reaping, I shall be soon, I shall be soon.
Then it was that Brown rose up. Again and again, blindly, he emptied his rifle at the schooner. Laughter floated up from the men and women, and from the peninsula came a splattering of return bullets. But the cracked tenor sang on, and Brown continued to fire until the hymns played out. It was that night that Grief and Mariri came back with but one calabash of water. A patch of skin 6 inches long was missing from Grief's shoulder in token of the scrape of the sandpaper hide of a shark whose dash he had eluded.
File 4.
In the early morning of another day, before the sun blaze had gained its full strength, came an offer of a parley from Raoul van Asveld. Brown brought the word in from the outpost among the rocks 100 yards away. Grief was squatted over a small fire, broiling a strip of shark flesh. The last 24 hours had been lucky. Seaweed and sea urchins had been gathered. Tehar had caught a shark, and Mariri had captured a fair-sized octopus at the base of the crevice where the dynamite was stored. Then, too, in the darkness, they had made 2 successful swims for water before the tiger sharks had nosed them out.
"I said he'd like to come and talk with you," Brown said. "But I know what the brute is after. Wants to see how near starved to death we are."
"Bring him in," Grief said.
"And then we kill him!"
the goat man cried joyously. Grief shook his head.
"But he's a killer of men, big brother, a beast and a devil!"
the goat man protested.
"He must not be killed, brother. It should be our way not to break our word."
"It is a foolish way."
"Still, it should be our way," Grief answered gravely, turning the strip of shark meat over the coals and noting the hungry sniff and look of Tehar. "Don't do that, Tehar, when the big devil comes. Look as if you and hunger were strangers. Here, cook those sea urchins, and you, big brother, cook the squid. We will have the big devil to feast with us. Spare nothing. Cook all." And still broiling meat, Grief arose as Raoul van Asveld, followed by a large Irish terrier, strode into camp. Raoul did not make the mistake of holding out his hand.
"Hello," he said. "I have heard of you."
"I wish I'd never heard of you," Grief answered.
"Same here," was the response. "At first, before I knew who it was, I thought I had to deal with an ordinary trading captain. That's why you've got me bottled up."
"And I'm ashamed to say that I underrated you," Grief smiled. "I took you for a thieving beachcomber, and not for a really intelligent pirate and murderer. Hence the loss of my schooner.
Honours are even, I fancy, on that score. Raoul flashed angrily under his sunburn, but he contained himself. His eyes roved over the supply of food and the full water calabashes, though he concealed the incredulous surprise he felt. His was a tall, slender, well-knit figure, and Grief, studying him, estimated his character from his face. The eyes were keen and strong, but a bit too close together. Not pinched, however, but just a trifle too near to balance the broad forehead, the strong chin and jaw, and the cheekbones wide apart. Strength! His face was filled with it. And yet Grief sensed in it the intangible something the man lacked.
"We are both strong men," Raoul said with a bow. "We might have been fighting for empires 100 years ago."
It was Grief's turn to bow.
"As it is, we are squalidly scrapping over the enforcement of the laws of those empires."
"It all comes to dust," Raoul remarked sententiously, sitting down. "Go ahead with your meal. Don't let me interrupt."
"Won't you join us?" was Grief's invitation.
The other looked at him with sharp steadiness, then accepted.
"I'm sticky with sweat," he said. "Can I wash?"
Grief nodded and ordered Mariri to bring a calabash. Raoul looked into the goat man's eyes, but saw nothing save languid disinterest as the precious quart of water was wasted on the ground.
"The dog is thirsty,"
Raoul said. Grief nodded, and another calabash was presented to the animal. Again, Raoul searched the eyes of the natives, and learned nothing.
"Sorry we have no coffee," Grimes apologized. "We'll have to drink plain water. Calabash tail. Try some of this shark. There is squid to follow, and sea urchins and a seaweed salad. I'm sorry we haven't any frigate bird. The boys were lazy yesterday and didn't try to catch any."
With an appetite that would not have stopped at wire nails dipped in lard, Grief ate perfunctorily and tossed the scraps to the dog.
"I'm afraid I haven't got down to the primitive diet yet," he sighed as he sat back. "The canned food on the Rattler, now I could make a hearty meal of that. But this junk..."
He took a half-pound strip of broiled shark and flung it to the dog.
"I suppose I'll come to it if you don't surrender pretty soon."
Raoul laughed unpleasantly.
"I came to offer terms," he said pointedly.
Grief shook his head.
"There aren't any terms. I've got you where the hair is short, and I'm not going to let go." "You think you can hold me in this hole?" Raoul cried. "You'll never leave it alive except in double irons."
Grief surveyed his guest with an air of consideration.
"I've handled your kind before. It's been pretty well cleaned out of the South Seas, but you are a sort of anachronism. You're a throwback, and we've got to get rid of you. Personally, I would advise you to go back to the schooner and blow your brains out. It's the only way to escape what you've got coming to you."
The parley, so far as Raoul was concerned, proved fruitless, and he went back into his own lines convinced that the men on the big rock could hold out for years, though he would have been swiftly unconvinced could he have observed Tehar and the Raiateans the moment his back was turned and out of sight, crawling over the rocks and sucking and crunching the scraps his dog had left uneaten.
"We hunger now, brother," Grief said, "but it is better than to hunger for many days to come. The big devil, after feasting and drinking good water with us in plenty, will not stay long in Fuatino. Even tomorrow he may try to leave. Tonight you and I sleep over the top of the rock, and Tehar, who shoots well, will sleep with us if he can dare the rock."
Tehar, alone among the Raiateans, was cragsman enough to venture the perilous way, and dawn found him in a rock-barricaded nook 100 yards to the right of Grief and Mariri. The first warning was the firing of rifles from the peninsula, where Brown and his 2 Raiateans signalled the desperado's retreat and followed the besiegers through the jungle to the beach. From the eyrie on the face of the rock, Grief could see nothing for another hour, until the Rattler appeared, making for the passage. As before, the captive Fuatino men towed with the whaleboat. Mariri, under the direction of Grief, called down instructions to them as they passed slowly beneath.
By Grief's side lay several bundles of dynamite sticks, well lashed together and with extremely short fuses. The deck of the Rattler was crowded. Forward, rifle in hand among the Raiatean sailors, stood a desperado whom Mariri announced was Raoul's brother. Aft, by the helmsman, stood another. Attached to him, tied waist to waist with slack, was Mataara, the old queen. On the other side of the helmsman, his arm in a sling, was Captain Glass. Amidships, as before, was Raoul, and with him, lashed waist to waist, was Namu.
"Good morning, Mr. David Grief,"
Raoul called up.
"I warned you that only in double irons would you leave the island,"
Grief murmured down with a sad inflection.
"You can't kill all your people I have on board,"
was the answer. The schooner, moving slowly, jerk by jerk as the men pulled in the whaleboat, was almost directly beneath. The rowers, without ceasing, slacked on their oars, and were immediately threatened with the rifle of the man who stood forward.
"Throw, big brother,"
Namu called up in the Fuatino tongue.
"I am filled with sorrow, and am willing to die. His knife is ready with which to cut the rope, but I shall hold him tight. Be not afraid, big brother. Throw, and throw straight, and goodbye."
Grief hesitated, then lowered the fire stick which he had been blowing bright.
"Throw,"
the goat man urged. Still, Grief hesitated.
"If they get to sea, big brother, Namu dies just the same. And there are all the others. What is her life against the many?"
"If you drop any dynamite or fire, a single shot will kill all on board,"
Raoul cried up to them.
"You can't kill these people, and I can. Shut up, you!"
This last was addressed to Namu, who was calling up in her native tongue, and whom Raoul seized by the neck with one hand to choke to silence. In turn, she locked both arms about him and looked up beseechingly to Grief.
"Throw him, Mr. Grief, and be damned to them!"
Captain Glass rumbled in his deep voice.
"They're bloody murderers! The captain's full of them!"
The desperado, who was fastened to the old queen, swung half about to menace Captain Glass with his rifle, when Taha, from his position further along the rock, pulled his trigger on him. The rifle dropped from the man's hand, and on his face was an expression of intense surprise as his legs crumpled under him and he sank down on deck, dragging the queen with him.
"Port! Hard a port!"
Grief cried. Captain Glass and the Kanaka whirled the wheel over, and the bow of the Rattler headed in for the rock. Amidships, Raoul still struggled with Namu. His brother ran from forward to his aid, being missed by the fusillade of quick shots from Tehar and the goat man. As Raoul's brother placed the muzzle of his rifle to Namu's side, Grief touched the fire stick to the match head in the split end of the fuse. Even as with both hands he tossed the big bundle of dynamite, the rifle went off, and Namu's fall to the deck was simultaneous with the fall of the dynamite. This time the fuse was short enough. The explosion occurred the instant the deck was reached, and that portion of the Rattler, along with Raoul, his brother, and Namu, forever disappeared. The schooner's side was shattered, and she began to settle immediately. Forward, every Raiatean sailor dived overboard. Captain Glass met the first man springing up the companionway from the cabin with a kick full in the face, but was overborne and trampled on by the rush. Following the desperados came the Huahine women, and as they went overboard, the Rattler sank on an even keel close to the base of the rock. Her cross-trees still stuck out when she reached bottom. Looking down, Grief could see all that occurred beneath the surface. He saw Mataara, a fathom deep, unfasten herself from the dead pirate and swim upward. As her head emerged, she saw Captain Glass, who could not swim, sinking several yards away. The queen, old woman that she was, turned over, swam down to him, and held him up as she struck out for the unsubmerged cross-trees. Five heads, blonde and brown, were mingled with the dark heads of Polynesia that dotted the surface. Grief, rifle in hand, watched for a chance to shoot. The goat man, after a minute, was successful, and they saw the body of one man sink sluggishly. But to the Raiatean sailors, big and brawny, was the vengeance given. Swimming swiftly, they singled out the blonde heads and the brown. Those from above watched the four surviving desperadoes clutched and locked, dragged far down beneath and drowned. In 10 minutes everything was over. The Huaheine women, laughing and giggling, were holding on to the sides of the whaleboat which had done the towing. The Raiatean sailors, waiting for orders, swam about the cross-tree to which Captain Glass and Mataara clung.
"Poor old Rattler,"
Captain Glass lamented.
"Ah, nothing of the sort," Grief called down. "In a week we'll have her raised, new timbers amidships, and we'll be on our way."
And to the Queen, "How is it with you, sister?"
"No more is gone, and Motari, brother, but Fortino is ours again. The day is young. Word shall be sent to all my people in the high places with the goats, and tonight, once again, and as never before, we shall feast and rejoice in the big house."
"Well, she's been needing new timbers abaft the beam there for years," commented Captain Glass. "But the chronometers will be out of commission for the rest of the cruise."
The end.